Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. I am your host, Logan Bartlett, and what you're going to hear on this episode is a conversation I had with Jody Bonsall. Jody was the founder and CEO of AppDynamics, which sold in 2017 to Cisco for $3.7 billion right before it went public. We talk about that sale, as well as Jody now running two separate businesses. He is the CEO of Harness, which not coincidentally was most recently valued at $3.7 billion, as well as the CEO of Traceable.ai, which was recently valued at $450 million. In this conversation, Jody and I talk about a bunch of different things related to operating and his different frameworks for making decisions for finding product market fit, hiring executives, firing executives, as well as the saddest day he had running AppDynamics, which was the day he actually sold the business to Cisco. A really interesting conversation, one of the more thoughtful and tactical leaders that exist in the world of startups. And so hope you enjoy that conversation with Jody here now. And if you're enjoying this show, please do like, share, and subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening to us on. It really does go a long way to helping us continue to grow and have other people find our shows. So without further ado, here's Jody. Jody, thanks for doing this. So I want to get this right. So you're the founder of AppDynamics, sold to Cisco for $3.7 billion in 2017. But today you have three separate jobs-ish. So I want to get this right. Harness, Traceable, and Unusual. So Harness has about 800 people, most recently valued at $3.7 billion. Was that that couldn't have been an accident?
Yes, you know, that's the that was the goal I was shooting for.
Yeah,
the valuations don't mean anything, but still, like, you know, you have, you know, a good number is a good number.
You sold AppD for 3.7.
Yeah. And it was kind of the 5-year mark of selling AppD, and I wanted to get, like, you know, that was the goal, 5-year. Let's try to get to the number.
Yeah, that's great. Traceable has about how many people?
About 175.
175, and most recently valued at?
450.
450 million. And then Unusual Ventures has a billion under management, roughly?
Yeah, about like 1.2 billion.
And so you're the CEO of the first two, and you're a partner on the third. So you have way more jobs than most people. How do you actually spend your days? Like, how do you allocate your time across those different things?
First of all, I don't think of, like, you know, a lot of people ask me this thing. That's probably the number one question. Like, how do you do this, all this?
It's unusual. Really, I mean,
You know, I really don't think in terms of time management. I really think of, like, you know, where do I have to make impact? And I even call it, like, impact management now. Just like, if I'm not making impact, you know, it's not worth spending time on those things. And if you tune for that, like, you know, where impact could be, like, you know, if you're spending time, can you move the needle? If you're not spending time, can you move the needle negatively as well, right? So that's both impact on both sides. And I like to maximize most of my time on those. And that can change, like, you know, that can change. Because we end up spending a lot of time on things that, you know, it's not going to move the needle one way or the other. If I reduce that, then creates a lot of time, free up a lot of time. Like, you're not doing just unnecessary things for the sake of it. But, you know, you have some patterns that you have to follow. You know, I follow some, like, you know, that's the, like, the regularly scheduled meetings for Harness happens on one day, and, you know, for Traceable happens on one day, and rest are kind of free-flowing. So I kind of try to keep, like, no more than one-third of my calendar, which is, like, just locked up on things. You know, so it's, like, free-flowing, and I can figure out what to do.
And so does the time end up balancing, I guess, over the course of the year? At any point in time, it might oscillate up or down on the companies itself, but does it end up being 50-50 over the course of a year, or some years is it 30% here, 70% there?
You know, I don't even
know.
I don't even know. I don't like to interact like that.
Yeah.
I look at, like, you know, are the companies doing well? You know, which are the areas? If some area needs a lot of work, like, you know, requires, like, you have to really, really drill down and spend, like, you know, 50 hours a week on something, you know, you find time to make that happen. You know, if you don't have to do that, that's great. Like, you know, but if you just, you have to find time to make forward progress. That's how I look at it. I don't look back at a year and say, where did I spend my time? It's like, you know, I look back at the year and say, what did we do in the last year?
Do you have overlapping investors between the two companies?
Yes. Unusual Ventures is
So your venture firm invested in both.
Yes. And one of the firms, IVP, is invested in both.
Got it.
Yeah, that's it.
Did the other venture investors ask this question? Or is it like, hey, you sold a company for $3.7 billion, so we're sort of just in the Jody Bonsall business?
It's a very natural question.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Everyone asks me, and they should ask me, like, how do you do, you know, three different things? And, you know, I tell them, like, and I'd do it as long as I think I'm doing a great job at it, you know, or if I think my time is becoming a constraint and doing it right, then I will, you know, see that maybe I should not do it. And your time doesn't become constrained if you, you know, look in more in terms of impact and how do you are making the doing the right things that will change the trajectory of the company in the right way. One is that. Second is you still have to set the tone of the as CEOs of the business. As you're doing that, are you building the right, you know, bringing the right vision, the right, you know, the alignment across the different leaders that's there. But I also like to work long hours. You know, it's not, for me, like 60, 65, maybe 70 hours is not, you know, abnormal. If not doing that, I feel like I'm slacking that week.
Yeah.
But it's my choice. Like, it's not that anyone is asking me to do it. You know, it's, you know, I don't have too much interest in playing golf or, like, you know, doing things that, you know, this is what I enjoy.
When people give me shit about having a podcast as well, I'm going to point at you and say, like, if this guy can do all of that, then I can do, I can get behind a mic once a week to talk to
totally,
people.
Why not? Like, you know, it's if you are enjoying it, you know, and you can balance it, it's like, I look at, like, we are all smart enough, mature enough at this point, and or these, you know, where we are in our careers and lives, that we learn how to manage, you know, different priorities. It's not like, you know, when you have to really, really tightly track your time and figure out the priorities, like, you know, it's all about prioritization.
You're assuming a lot in the that I am mature, but I appreciate that sentiment there. So do you keep? I'll let this topic go in a second. But you said you keep about a third of your schedule unbooked, and that's for things as it comes up and kind of variable things. Is there anything else that you do interesting with your calendar?
Well, I like to see, like, you know, you have, like, almost like recurring meetings, like, you know, weekly,
sure,
you know, executive staff meeting, you know, every 2 weeks, you know, in both my companies, we have all hands meetings. You have, like, you know, one-on-ones, things like that, like, so which are, like, just on the calendar, either once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month, once a quarter, whatever it is, right? I like to keep them to fill no more than 35% of my calendar is normally my rule. So then the rest of the time, you can plan and you can adjust on, you know, what you need to do where to make the most impact. You know, you obviously need the recurring things to have the cadence in your business. But what I've seen in many times, like, your whole 100% of the calendar is filled with just recurring things, but you don't have time to do anything else. So that's like I like to keep simple and kind of make sure, like, you know, I have flexibility.
Does that time, the two-thirds, does that tend to get filled with other meetings that are sensitive, time sensitive in some way, or does it tend to get filled with deep thought and stuff for you to where you can make the biggest impact? Or is it?
No, it really depends on what's going on.
Yeah.
Let's say, you know, I like to spend time with customers, so that's, like, that's there. Like, and I want to go and meet customers. I like to spend time, like, recruiting, and, like, say sometimes you're recruiting for some key hire. You know, maybe your whole 2 weeks are filled. You know, majority of the time you are spending in trying to recruit the right person there, right? So, you know, sometimes it's like it might be just deep in the product with the product teams. The deep thought of, like, and I'm sitting in a cave somewhere and doing deep thought, I don't think so.
Yeah, that's a venture person.
But that happens also sometimes. Like, you know, you just want to, you know, put your headphones and, you know, and maybe research something and think about something. But that's to me, is happening,
yeah.
You know, all the time. Yeah.
Now, I talked to one of your investors, Matt Murphy from Menlo, who worked with you as well at AppDynamics, and he said that you have a number of really interesting frameworks, and he was very complimentary about how you have been able to go about finding product market fit. So I want to ask about that. But one of the things that you did have a structured framework that I heard you talk about was evaluating opportunities for entrepreneurs. And so I think you said there are three different components in how you thought about it: evaluating the market size, the actual need for the product in the market, and then the passion for the opportunity. Can you talk about, like, that framework and how you give that advice to the founders?
Yeah. You know, that's the number one question, like, you know, people think of a lot of time. Like, I have this idea, should I quit my job and start a company, or should I start a company about it? And people ask for this thing all the time, right? As an engineer, I like to create frameworks for most things, at least some basic mental frameworks. So that's,
you have a lot of good ones, by the way. I'm going to ask you about a bunch of them.
Right.
Yeah.
So my framework on this is, like, I look at, like, you know, first of all, you have to look at, you know, do people care about solving this problem? You know, that's like, is this a real pain that the world cares about? You know, second is, does the world, many people in the world care about it, or just a small number of people?
So that's the market size one. How big is this market?
You know, and I look at, like, let's say someone has an idea that, you know, I want to build a trampoline for dogs to jump on. You know, do people care about it? Like, maybe some people do. Like, if, like, 100 people in the world care about it, do you really want to start a company on that? The third is then, you know, so you have to really validate that. And I look at, like, you know, you have to talk to a lot of people to figure out, like, you know, is it a big problem that a lot of people care about? Is it real problem that people will pay for solving? And then if you figure those two out, then you look at, like, are you really, really passionate about this problem yourself? And do you, I also, you know, ask people to look at, like, are, do you have some kind of a unique insight, expertise, something about this?
The why you.
You know, why you part of it? Because if it's a real problem that the world cares about solving, like, can you really win in solving this? Right. So then that, you know, so if you want to, like, if I have to start a company in fashion something, you know, even though it's some real problem is there that I identify, there's very unlikely that I'm going to win. I don't really have any unique insight, unique expertise, unique something. So that's, maybe you should not start a company there. So I look at the simple test if you can do, you know, that you're pretty convinced that the market is large, pretty convinced that the problem is what is, like, people going to spend money on solving this problem in some way. And, you know, that you are willing to, you know, spend a lot of time because you're passionate about this problem, and you have some unique expertise or insight. That's a good thing. Like, then you jump in and start the company.
Do you think about if the market is large today, or do you pick a point in the future and say, "Hey, can this be large if X, Y, Z happens?"
It's a combination of things. I do think you know, and I've tried to create a framework around it, but didn't really work well on that topic. But still, I feel roughly about, like, I feel like 2 years is about a good, you know, future reference. Like, where do you think, like, you know, okay, it's, or if the market is not today, if it's fine if it's there 2 years from now. If it's going to be 5 years from now, your startup may not survive that 5 years. Like, you know, you have to have, you know, very, very unique spot to have so much capital to survive through that. So I feel like 2 years is the right, if the market is right now very, very ripe, there's a high chance you're a bit late. You know, and so I feel like 2 years is about the right time, like, you know, where the puck is going 2 years from now, because you can find early adopters now. If something is going to be, like, you know, ripe and mainstream, like, 2 years from now, there will be good number of early adopters today. So you go after the early adopters now. 2 years from now, it starts getting more mainstream. You know, that's where most people are getting to. So you're ready to go and capture the mainstream at that point. You know, that's kind of roughly I like to follow the as a rule.
Now, you've had to find product market fit a few different times, starting a few different companies, as well as investing and having seen it. How do you think about what framework you apply to making sure the component outside of the market size? The second one was, will the dogs actually eat the dog food, right? Or will the dogs jump on the trampoline, to use your example? What's the methodology and process that you go about evaluating this?
Product market fit is such a vague process. Like, you know, you ask 10 people, there'll be 10 definitions to begin with. How do you go to product market fit is really, most people think it's just a dark art. You know, so we have tried to create a framework around that. And, you know, I've brought in my experiences from AppDynamics and Harness and Traceable and, you know, everything that I've seen. And, you know, at Unusual, what we write a lot about it. We have the Unusual Field Guide to talk about it, which and to create, share the experiences. Kind of can bring it down into a few areas, like, which is, one is that focus on real cold outreach to get to the, to have real conversations. What happens many times is, like, you know, you start as a founder, you find some friends and family, some investors will introduce you. You are, if you're in place like Silicon Valley, there will be the Silicon Valley echo chamber. You'll talk to, like, you know, people you know in Silicon Valley, and you just not hear the right feedback. Like, so if you can find people cold who will be your likely target buyers at some point, and they will even take a meeting with you, and you can validate something with them, you know, that's a good sign. So that's what I would say, first part of the framework, like, you know, don't just go in this warm meetings at all. I remember at, you know, AppDynamics, I first started there as one of our investors. So let me introduce you to some banks in New York. And, you know, the investor had a few connections there. And, you know, I did a trip to Wall Street, you know, and this was, like, company was four people. And I did a trip to Wall Street, you know, I didn't want to spend any money. So, you know, took up, you know, changed my shirt and, you know, washed my face in a Starbucks too, so that I don't have to pay a hotel room. But then I did the whole, like, I met, like, seven different banks in one day, like, back to back. Came back, like, oh, great set of meetings, you know, high fives to our team, like, you know, we have found the product market fit, like, have great meetings. And then I started following up with those seven people, like, you know, hey, we had a great meeting in New York, and, you know, following up on being a beta customer or something. No one even responded. You know, and that clicked to me. It's like, you know, that those people took the meeting because, you know, it was a warm intro. They wanted to be nice to the person making the intro. And the meeting was good because they wanted to be nice to me. Because, you know, they just, if you're a founder who are passionate about your thing, they don't want to be, like, you know, tell in your face that, you know, your thing is not good, or they don't care about your thing, or they don't need your thing. And since then, I realized, like, you know, the best way to get real good feedback is cold. Like, you know, you reach out to people cold on LinkedIn. If you're not been getting a response from anyone, there's a good chance that, like, you know, no one cares about your problem, or, like, you know, or your message, or how you're talking about it. if people take the cold meeting with you, there's a good sign that that means there is a interest in this thing. You know, if the meetings go well after that, where they don't really have an obligation of any kind to be nice to you, you know, that's a good sign as well, right? So that's really the first part of it. Second is, you know, do a lot of it. You know, people, a lot of people do, like, you know, I talk to three people or five people, and, you know, this one customer we talked to here, you know, they said this thing and they're excited and ready to go. And, you know, I'd like to tell everyone is, like, you know, you got to look at least 30 to 50 conversations, you know, and the conversations to the point where the test is when you're hearing the same things. You know, it's the, if you start hearing the same things, that means you have found, you've done enough conversations, that you're not really learning anything new. It's the same things again and again. And the third is being iterative about this. Like, whenever the first thing you start with, like, you say, this is the problem you're solving, this is why our differentiated technology solution to solve this problem is, you know, your message and story would not be right the first time. Like, so you do five conversations, you iterate, and do another five, and you iterate, another five, you iterate. By the time you're at 40 conversations, you kind of figure out the solution of how you sell it and how you talk about it, and do you have the right product market fit or not. So I like to promote that, and that's what, you know, we talk a lot about that on Newswell as well, which is the this kind of framework of go cold, you know, in outreach, do a high volume, so you're not, like, biased by a few, and iterate quickly on that. And then you have, like, a sort of a good definition of your 40, 50 people who are saying the same things. You figure out how to, like, you know, talk about this, the differentiation, the product, the, you know, the pain. That's the basis of a good product market fit.
So you've gone cold to these people. You've heard validation of product market fit being there, at least commonalities that they're using the same words. Mm-hmm. Now you start building the product. And there's a balance between speed and product quality. And there's a tension between those two. How do you think about that now that you've heard this feedback going back to those customers and saying, hey, we have it? What's your framework for making that?
I think this one, a lot comes down to what is the market, right? You know, if you're going in a market where there's no existing incumbent, speed is important, like, you know, because the quality bar could be low. The quality as in, like, you know, the completeness of features, etc. Like, you know, because it's something is better than nothing. If there's
the MVP is low, the minimum viable.
You know, you used to have this whole lean startup thing. And people got too crazy on the lean startup thing. Like, you know, people will come in, like, build this thing very lean and then this thing. Now, look at, like, if you're going in a market with a lot of incumbent players, or, like, strong incumbent players, the lean startup thing doesn't work. Like, no one is going to buy your lean MVP. And so it's like, you know, you have to find something that's, you know, many times it's like you have to get to at least the, you know, the some kind of parity with the incumbent if you want to go and replace the incumbent. And if incumbent has a lot of, you know, important features, you have to go and get parity. And then you build the differentiation on top of that, right? So your MVP definition is very different, depends on how strong the incumbents are. And so to me, it's like, you know, how what you build out, it depends on that. Like, you know, it's like if you look at, say, you know, great example was Workday. You know, when Workday was starting to, like, we're going to be the SaaS version of PeopleSoft. People will replace PeopleSoft with Workday. Now, if you apply the, like, you know, let's start with a very small subset of the PeopleSoft features. And now no one is going to replace PeopleSoft with Workday. So even your MVP V1 has to have everything that PeopleSoft will do. And that's your differentiation is that you're SaaS, PeopleSoft was not SaaS. So that's, you know, but your MVP bar is high. So you have to finish that to go and build that market. If you're going into a completely new market where there's no one there, then yeah, you start fast. So that's how I would balance it.
What about in the product development life cycle? So now there actually is a product that's out there in the wild, and you've either gotten it quickly or you've built for a while, and you're trying to take feedback. And there's a bunch of different constituents that can give you feedback, right? There's your own intuition, which then there's salespeople out there talking in the field. There's what your engineering team thinks. There's what their product team thinks. All of them are probably... Ideally, they'd be singing the same tune, but probably all have different competing priorities.
They are not, and they're competing priorities. And I would say the product leadership team in a startup has to, or any company really, but startup normally the founders and CEOs will be the product leaders. You have to manage that. You know, actually, I've written about this framework in a post called the four lists that someone has to manage. The one list is, you know, what your customers are asking for. You know, and customers are asking for, hey, I don't have this feature, I don't have this feature, I can't adopt. And if they're unhappy about something, they can, you know. And so you have to build that list. The second list would be what your salespeople are saying, that, you know, we don't have this feature, we're losing this deal. Or, you know, our competitors are really putting things in the market that we can't compete with, you know, unless we have these things, etc. So The third list after that is your kind of like technical debt that builds up over time, like, you know, architectural debt, quality debt, you know, different kind of things, which the engineers are asking for. Hey, we need to stop building features and do this, otherwise everything will crash, or we will have performance issues, or we'll have, like, you know, security issues or whatnot, right? And the fourth list, you know, which is I call like the kind of your vision list, which is like where do you need to grow the your TAM, your market, your opportunity, like the new, you know, many times when you start something, anything, like you have a big vision and you start with maybe 50% of that initially, and now you have to build the rest, and, you know, maybe your vision is growing over time as well. So that's the fourth list. So anytime you almost have to balance the four, like, you know, it's like, you know, your four lists, let's say you're doing a planning for one quarter of engineering work or one sprint of engineering work. You pick some things from each of the list and say, okay, that's your plan for this quarter or this sprint. And things can change. Like, you know, you're losing a lot of customers, you know, on churn. You may have to fill most of your work with that. And if you're losing a lot of deals to customers, to competitors, because you don't have like one feature that's like your competitor is kicking your ass on that one feature, you have to, you know, prioritize that. You know, but it's normally you want a balance of things along those four.
Do you actually have those lists written out? And you're checking them off, and I assume some of them double overlap, and they do.
Like, and, you know, normally we'll have, like, you know, let's say the feature requests that are coming from customers, you know, we'll make them, like, you know, as a list, and these are, like, you know, mechanisms we'll use, like, you know, maybe tags or something, like we'll you can filter in Jira, and you say, okay, these are the list of all the feature requests coming from customers. You're prioritizing it. The product managers are managing that backlog. You know, you have another list that's coming from, like, you know, sales people, most likely sales engineers, who are, like, you know, maintaining a list of the feature gaps you have compared, you know, why you're losing a deal, etc. And then the engineers maintaining their tech. And so these are all, like, you know, the lists are there very openly for us, you know, and then we kind of manage the when we plan, we balance them out. The framework works very well. Like, you know, I've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it's a simple framework, but I do think, like, you know, having that mindset of, like, you know, that it's always a balance of those four, and you make a conscious decision on what you're taking from those, and you know, and also, like, you know, sometimes you're also making conscious decision on where do you spend your dollars on, right? You know, let's say, you know, the fourth bucket is like the with your vision kind of bucket, is you're also expanding your addressable market, like, because if you keep doing what you're doing in the first three buckets, maybe, like, you know, you're fine for this year, but, like, you know, that's how you look at, like, say you're doing $5 million revenue this year and your plan is to $20 million next year. That's, you have to start building towards, like, do you have enough addressable market, and do you have enough, like, you know, you have to expand into adjacent areas for that going from 5 to 20, you know, so you have to invest into that far ahead, right? So it's key as well.
I've heard you say that you structure your teams as startups within startups, and there's some way of operating in which you assume or that you encourage the team to assume that the other departments aren't actually good at their job and that they need to be the best at what they're doing. Can you talk about, like, what a startup within a startup actually means for these different departments?
Sure. Two different things, though. The startup within startup, when I set it up, it's more around the product areas. Like, you know, it's like, say, and I look at, like, you know, most companies will start with, like, one product or one, call it, like, one product, one major use case that you are focused on, you know, and you will start slowing down on your growth if you only do that one. So at some point you have to go from one to two, so your second product to third product to fourth product, and, like, you know, most of the markets you have to keep growing into a platform at some point. Like, you know, if you want to be $1 billion revenue, it's hard to do it without becoming a platform. But it's very hard to innovate, you know, in building a second product successfully or a third product successfully for the companies. And that's where I you know, like this kind of a model of, you know, when you're building a second product, almost start that as a startup inside the company. You know, and what that means is, like, you know, when you start your first product as a startup, as a real startup, you normally have a small team, maybe, like, you know, 5-6 engineers working on it, you know, who are very driven about, you know, finding the product market fit, building, moving fast. You know, they're not slowed down by processes and the burden that comes with it. So when you're building a second product, you want to do the same thing, you know, which is not what normally happens. Like, you know, if you have your first product is mature and selling, and, you know, you at that time you have to mature your processes on quality and how you do engineering and how you talk to customers, and you have, like, you know, how you sell it. All of those are, like, you know, are designed for that mature scale. And now you try to build the same things on your product number two, it just fails. Like, so I like to do, like, you know, product number two, build exactly, go back to exactly how you build your product number one successfully, and it should not be any different. You know, when you build your product number three, it's the same kind of thing, right? So I like to structure these when you build new products into like a sort of a small startup inside the company. And even the funding model is very similar to a startup. Like, you know, when we look at like, you know, let's say when you're building the, you're starting building the product, you normally need like 5-6 engineers. And once you start getting to, let's say, you know, call it the seed stage startup, for, right? And when you start getting to like, say, 500,000, 1,000,000 of kind of revenue, then you kind of grow that to, you know, 10, 15 engineers. You know, when you start getting to, you know, maybe 3 to 5 million of revenue in that, then you start growing it to like, you know, 20, 25 people, you know, in that product kind of startup. When you start growing it from like, you know, maybe 10, 15 million revenue, then you put it to like 30, 40 engineers. At some point it starts like you don't need it. So, but you can even tie your investment not too different than like how the venture kind of investment worked. And to me, that model has worked so well. Like AppDynamics, we started with one product and we grew to like, you know, by the time we are going IPO and all that, we were about 9 products at that time. And, you know, that was why we were growing so fast. We were growing like almost business was almost doubling at that time because the 9 products we were able to build. At Harness, I kind of brought in the same model and tried to kind of do an even more mature version of that startup within startup model of like how we go from one product to much more. Like, you know, Harness, we are in the DevOps platform space and we started with one product, continuous delivery. And just in a few years, we have expanded into like, you know, we have 8 products in the market. We're really strong and competitive to the best in class players there. And people really ask, like, how do you build all these things? Like, you know, you have CD and you have, you know, CI and feature flags and cloud cost management and so many. There are separate startups that compete in all of these markets because of the startup within startup model that we have been able to do. So that's the startup within startup concept, which I really like, that, you know, it allows to scale. And to me, the inspiration always been Amazon on this. Like, and Amazon has done how Amazon became Amazon is this fundamentally a model like this. Like, that's how they have, you know, gone from like, you know, one product to second to third to like, you know, what they have gone into all these different markets and build amazing, you know, products in these markets. So it's kind of a similar-ish concept in the B2B kind of world that we bring in. Your second question was about like, you know, I think I talked about this at some point where I want every department to be, you know, excellent on its own. You know, it's like, I call it like what's a competitive advantage? Like, you know, some companies have that your competitive advantage is how you do engineering, that you do engineering so well that, you know, it's hard for, that becomes your competitive advantage. Some companies have like, you know, sales is your competitive advantage. Like they do, you know, the sales execution is so strong and that's your competitive advantage. You know, and people even say that, like, you know, the companies with engineering as a competitive advantage, like our product is so good, it sells by itself. We don't need sales and marketing people. And there's the sales. Sometimes the sales people comes from really good sales environments, right? They will say, you know, we had the 4th best product in our space, but our sales was so good, we still beat everyone because, you know, we are so good sellers, we can sell even like a comb to a bald guy kind of thing, right? So I start to like, you know, like, why not just have that as a mindset then, right? You know, which is not a mindset. So to engineers, I like to say, like, let's build a product that, you know, we can, you know, that is so good that we don't need the best sellers. And to the sales guys, I tell them, like, you know, let's bring the best sales execution, like, that you don't need the best product. You know, so we have both as a competitive advantage. And the other one I also look at is, like, is a customer success. Like, you know, can you make customer success as a competitive advantage that your customers are saying, hey, these guys are so good in supporting the customers that we want to buy from, you know, that. And then I've seen that's a competitive, like, you know, becomes a competitive advantage as well. You can have your marketing brand as a competitive advantage as well. So I like to say, like, you know, if you have one competitive advantage that your product is great, but other threes are not, that's still fine. But you get 2 or 3 as competitive advantage that buy on it on their own, they are a big competitive strength and advantage. Why not? And then you combine them, then it becomes like, you know, really powerful.
Before founding AppDynamics, you were an engineer at Wiley, which was kind of a V1 to AppDynamics' cloud version of the product. And you went from that to CEO of a... How many people did AppD have?
About 1,500.
So you scaled along the way. I'd be interested in that path and going from figuring out how to manage all these people and all that. But one of the things on the journey that I thought was particularly unusual that you've alluded to is you really found religion on sales and enterprise sales. And even at the beginning, when I asked you how you spend your time, you talked about meeting customers and recruiting, which are both sales. Was there a mentor or someone that sort of taught you that path, or did you just figure out this was something you needed to become best in breed? Because especially at the time you were doing this, 2008, 2009, 2010, there was all the no salespeople, Optimizely mindset of let the product sell itself. We'll never need salespeople again.
You know, first of all, let me correct on the where I spend my time. The core of it, I'm a product guy. So the where I like to spend the most of my time is product. You know, it's like so customers recruiting, you know, can take a lot of time, which is great. But where I run most of my time is product. And actually, in most of my companies, I'm the chief product officer as well. Like, you know, AppDynamics, I was the chief product officer. I don't hire chief product officer because I consider that's my job and that's my strength. And same in Harness, like, you know, I'm the chief product officer. I run the product myself, like the product teams, I don't have a senior level product leader because of that. And that's where a majority of my time goes. So that's, you know, just wanted to correct that. Yeah. But you can't build you know, great products without talking to customers, especially in our kind of space, where the B2B kind of enterprise kind of space. So that's why you have to spend a lot of time with customers there. But being a product guy, you know, that's where the challenge is, like, and how do you find religion in sales as well, right? So I'll tell you, like, at AppDynamics, you are about, our product was very strong. You know, we are the best product in the market. You know, we are growing rapidly. You know, we are about, like, you know, grew from the just launched the company. We were in maybe 7-8 million of ARR, growing fast there. And I met with Dave Itticheria, who's the CEO at MongoDB now. He was trying to figure out what to do at that point. He just left BMC at that time. And I met him for breakfast, and we were talking about this, like, you know, that our product is doing so well. And I was also in this thing of, like, you know, the product, it's all about the great product, which I, you know, that's my strength, that's my superpower is. And that we had all these advantages in our product. And Dave was like, you know, this is all great, but, you know, what, imagine, like, you know, what you, if you have the similar kind of advantages on the sales execution as well. And if you can combine the two. And, you know, that's really what started me, started me on that kind of journey on, like, you know, can you combine a great product with a great sales execution? You know, that what happens at that point. That was his challenge to me. Like, you know, can you combine the two? Like, you know, your great product combined with great sales execution. Then I met with John McMahon right after. John McMahon, as many of your listeners and all will know, is kind of the legend in the enterprise selling world. It came from this company PTC, which became a legendary company on how the sales, you know, sales was done in a very scientific way. He became an advisor to AppDynamics, and I learned a lot from him, you know, on what does, you know, selling means. You know, when I started as an engineer, I thought selling was like, you know, slick guys with like slick hair, vining and dining and playing golf, and that's the only way you do sales. You know, it was kind of this kind of a, almost like a black art, and which, by the way, most people still think that's how it is. Which really is not the case, you know. So that's what, you know, spending time with the likes of John McMahon, you know, you start learning there's a science behind enterprise sales, like, you know, the science of, like, you know, the how it's all works, like how can you do it in a repeatable, scalable kind of way, and that really fascinated me. Like, you know, you don't have this, like, you know product. I know how to build the great products, you know, but I almost felt like, you know, there's this black art of selling, you know, after that. And the only way you do that is product-led growth, et cetera, which is what, you know, what we're doing at AppDynamics early on. And then we tried, then once I learned that, you know, sales could also be more predictable and manageable and there could be a science behind sales, you know, I just got very fascinated about it. Like, that if you combine the two, then you get the best opportunity there. That's what we ended up building at AppDynamics. And, you know, that's how I look at, you know, Harness that we have built. That's all we are starting to build addressable to.
It's amazing the McMahon tree that permeates Silicon Valley at this point, the number of great companies that have sort of grown up under his tutelage. What if you were a first-time founder or a young founder that comes out of technical background, product-oriented and that, were there any lessons in particular that you have about thinking and even approaching understanding sales? You mentioned the architecture point and that there's actually methodology behind it, but any interesting things that you learned along the way that might be helpful to someone that's kind of first broaching this topic?
I think the number one, if, like, someone is new to understanding this, is sales is a numbers game. That really is the foundation of everything scientific about sales. that it's really a numbers game that you want to manage in the right way, which is like, you know, if you want to have $1 million of business, how many sales opportunities you need to have. You need to have maybe $3 to $4 million of sales opportunity. What does an opportunity mean that, you know, that it will convert like from $3 to $4 million to $1 million? What's the definition of it? You know, so that becomes a qualification and all that criteria, right? So you have a predictable rate of conversion from a numbers game from stage one to, you know, some stage to the final stage, you know, to get to a sales opportunity, how many meetings you need to do, you know, and it's eye-opening for many first-time, you know, engineer-turned founder CEOs. And it was eye-opening for me, like, you know, like to get one customer when you realize, okay, to get one customer, we need to have about somewhere around 15 to 20 meetings. And then you realize, like, you know, that we are like obsessing with every meeting, which is good, but really it's the numbers game of, like, you know, that I need to build a machine that I need 15 to 20 meetings. You know, the 15 to 20 meetings will convert to, like, you know, maybe five, six qualified sales opportunities that will get me, like, you know, two or three, you know, closed deals there, something like that, right? But that just realization that it's a funnel with a numbers game, and what you need to do is to manage the size of the funnel right, like at every place, but also the conversion rates at every place right and tune them in the right ways. That's the, you know, I would say the primary first time learning from an engineer to have around sales.
What about scaling as a leader? So you grew from just yourself as a solo founder, which I want to ask about, but then leading a very big team. What were some of the lessons about hiring people along the way, like different executives you brought in, different team members that you had from the AppD journey and then that you brought over to Harness?
You learn as you go, right? You know, a lot of times people think, like, you know, the answers are all figured out. Like, first-time founders, I tell them all the time, like, there's no point trying to learn everything, you know, upfront. You know, focus on what you need to do for the next 12 to 18 months and just try to learn that. Like, there's just Silicon Valley and the whole tech world is so bombarded by so much advice, by the way. And the advice...
Some guys even have podcasts for it.
Yes, you know, some guys who come and talk on podcasts and give exactly. advice, which, like, you know...
Yeah.
Look, sometimes that advice could be overwhelming and too much. Like, so you really focus on the way I like to think of is, like, you know, what you need to achieve in the next 12 to 18 months. That's the next major milestone. What do you need to learn in that for that, right? So you learn in that. And then as you go, you achieve that and you don't think about what beyond that too much. And then you go to the next one and you learn there. So same, when growing as an engineer turned first-time founder, to like managing the business, that's kind of how I look at it. Like, and when I just first starting, like, what was the success criteria for me for the very beginning was like raise capital, and, you know, hire an initial team of maybe 5-7 people, and build a good product market fit. So when I look at, like, you know, hiring team and learning skills for myself as well, it really came down to those three. Like, you know, I never raised capital before. Can I learn how to raise capital to get the company going? You know, I actually never recruited before. So can I convince like 5-7 engineers, good engineers to come and join me as there? And then can I find product market fit? And do I need people to help me through either of those three? Right. So that's your journey to building the team. Now you achieve that milestone, let's say, right? You know, which is like, say, a year, 18 months later. Now your next milestone is in early sales. Like, you know, that you need to find people to do, you know, you have, as a company, you have to get to the first million or two of sales and get the, you know, close your first deals, maybe launch your company out of stealth. So you need some marketing expertise to launch the company, get the messaging and positioning right. You need to have like the sales expertise to get that early sales going to, you know. So you need to find the people with those skills and you have to learn some of those skills, so, you know, into some level as well. Then you start getting to the next stage, like, you know, okay, now you are, you know, you have to start scaling your sales. Where, like, you know, you can't just have the founders with a few salespeople, you know, selling. You need to have now you need to find people who are good in those skills. Like, you know, how do you build a scalable sales organization? How do you do demand generation in a scalable way? You know, how do you do customer support in a scalable way? Your engineering team is growing. So how can you do, like, you know, more structured engineering, you know, at a scale? So now you start bringing those leaders and you learn how to manage them. Like, and then you go to the next level and now it's like, you know, about scaling even more and like you're running at like where it's not just one level of management. You have like 2-3 levels of management. What do you need to learn on that? Start getting closer to an IPO. It becomes a lot about financial management and financial tuning, and, you know, so it's all different skills, And I look at, like, you know, it's best just to just go as you, you know, and go deep into that particular skill area and bring the right people on hiring, you know, who are very good on those. Like, you know, so at any stage, you want to partner and bring the right people, you know, who some you can learn from also. And, you know, you who can, who have done some of those things before. So you are, you know, as a founder, you it becomes easier for you. I always look at, like, you know, the areas where I don't know too much, I need to hire someone who's extremely experienced and who has done that kind of job before. In areas where I know a lot, maybe I can hire someone who's not done that job before and is still fine. Like, I'll still feel comfortable. So that's how that's a framework I kind of done it. Well, I did at AppDynamics. Like, and I never did sales before. So the first time I wanted to, like, many people are like, just hire a sales rep or two or three sales reps, right? And I was like, if I can, I don't even know how to interview the sales reps and I don't even know how to manage them. Like, you know, so can I hire someone who has done that before? And, like, you know, so I can learn and they know how to hire sales reps and they have more experience. I don't need to teach them, you know, or I don't need to manage them in high amount of detail because I don't even know how to manage them. Right. So then I, you know, bring a VP of sales who knows how to do that. And then it becomes easier. And then you learn from them as you go. Right. So then you can improve at some point, you know, maybe now you can do sales better. Right.
In the interview process as well, you had said that you'll use that as a learning opportunity. And so maybe use VP of sales as an example or VP of marketing or something. How do you go about using, if that role exists, using that as an opportunity to really learn and get better yourself at it?
You know, interviews are great. You know, it's almost like a hack to learn about something. You know, let's say you want to figure out, like, if you want to hire a VP of demand generation for your company, and you have no idea, like, what really to hire it to look for, right? You know, if you're let's say you start interviewing people. You know, people will come in and you ask them, hey, how would you? This is where we are. Like, you know, right now we are at 5 million of revenue and we want to grow to, you know, 50 million of revenue over the next, this year. These are our constraints. We are not getting enough demand from here. Our product, like, is this. Our competitors are like this. You know, how would you build a demand generation program for our business to solve these problems? And what's your experience of, like, you know, success or failure of similar situations before that you know of, right? And someone who has done that before, they will tell you, like, you know, okay, this is what, you know, your plan, you know, if I was in this role, this is the plan I would build. This is what I would do. And they can also tell you, like, you know, we tried these things in my last job here. This worked well and this job didn't work well. And I've done this before what the learnings are. And now you have that conversation for, like, you know, with someone and you do with, like, you know, if you do with, like, 5 to 10 people, you will learn a lot. Like, you know, like, okay, what is the right, you know, plan for you, your company probably. Like, you know, it's almost like what I was talking about, the product market fit. Like, you know, at some point, the conversations start sounding the same. Same thing on this as well. Like, you know, because you start learning in the interview process, and then you can start asking the next level of questions, you know, and then, you know, what your plan should be and who is the right kind of person for your company as well. Right? So I find interview process quite a good, you know, it's a good hack to learn about something.
It sounds like it depends on the functional role that you would do this, but how do you think about hiring someone that's been there, done that? Because inevitably, if they're willing to join your company, mm-hmm. and they've been there, done that, there needs to be a reason that mm-hmm. they would go to, theoretically, an earlier stage business to go do it, versus taking a chance on someone that can be in their ascendancy of their career, mm-hmm. who is very high potential. And so which one of those did you orient more towards?
It's normally my teams have been a balance of the two. Like, half the teams would be on the, you know, young upcomers, you know, you take a chance on them and you kind of build on that. And half the team is very experienced people. And so it really depends on the person. And, you know, I normally would say I really like to take chance on people who are earlier. But at the same time, I do think, like, you know, if every function in your company is kind of like the same, you're taking some risk of lack of experience in the organization. So you have to kind of balance the team out. You know, it's on how your executive team is. Like, you know, in some functions, it's a good, you know, good seniority and been there, done there. And yes, it's hard to recruit, like, you know, been there, done there people if you're earlier, you know. But man, that's the beauty of the startup economics and the startup world, like, you know, and the startup people, like, you know, people who do want to come in earlier stages, you know, they who want to build, you know, they like the building, like, you know, and you want those people, you want, like, you know, that someone who has And maybe they've not gone, like, you know, let's say you're bringing someone who has gone from a, you know, 3 million to 25 million journey of a startup. And, you know, now maybe they want to go from, you know, 10 million to 75 million journey of, you know, this time. But they like that build up, the journey, the hyperscale. Those are the people you want to bring ideally, right? And but it's good that they have seen some of that, you know, what happens as you grow. And maybe they've not gone to the stage that we want to go this time, but it's still, those learnings are pretty powerful.
I heard you say that culture fit wasn't something that you hire for. Why is that the case?
I find the concept of culture fit very strange. Like, it's the way I look at it is like, you know, so you're hiring someone from Google, a very different culture. You're hiring someone from Apple is a strong culture. You're hiring someone from Amazon is a different culture. Now, if you ask them, like, you know, to assess the culture fit by, you know, tell me how you did XYZ in your current job. And they, if they're working Amazon, they will tell you, you know, this is how you do things. They're working at, you know, Apple, they will tell you in a different way what they, because that's how the company cultures are. So it's really a judgment on the person, on the culture, on like how they operate. You know, it's not really. So the way I look at them is like, you know, my company has a culture, Harness has a culture, Traceable has a culture, AppDynamics has a culture. Can this person fit in our culture? Which is very different than, like, you know, a lot of the culture fit is all about, like, you know, so I look at, like, you know, can we teach them our, you know, so we focus a lot on, like, teaching our culture instead of, like, you know, instead of trying to figure out the fit, etc. Like, you know, it's, if someone joins Apple, they will learn how to operate in Apple culture. Are they a fit there at the time they joined? Probably not. But if they're not willing to change how they operate, that's probably is a bigger problem. You know, if someone joins Amazon, they will operate in a very different way than they join Apple. So I look at, like, can we teach people to operate in our culture? Can we be deliberate about defining what our culture is? You know, and can we create a deliberate framework around that? And so to me, it's more about, like, can people go and learn our culture? Less about, like, you know, what culture, how they operate. And most of the culture fit then ends up about, like, you know, is this a, is this a person you want to grab a beer with? Which is an important thing. But the problem with that is, like, you know, that creates a lot of the kind of the lack of diversity, you know, everyone starts, you know, looking and feeling and talking the same. And that's why I don't really think too much about, you know, it's like testing for culture fit. You know, I look for, like, you know, hire the right people, you know, who are coachable, you know, smart and coachable is what we look for. And then we coach them our culture. You know, but that's, you know, and that's it.
Can you assess that in an interview process, or do you need to do reference calls to figure that type of thing out?
Most of the times you can do interview process. You know, if you have an interview process done with multiple people in the interview panel the right kind of ways, you can. The smart part is, like, you know, a lot of it is, like, you know, what they have done before but how you ask, like, multiple levels of questions in an interview on, you know, do they really have the depth in what they're talking about, you know, they have to really, you know, push the boundaries of something to solve, like, some hard problems. So that's you look for in that, you know, like, you have, like, you know, if you have four smart people interviewing someone and they all say, okay, this guy is pretty smart, there's a reasonable chance that guy is pretty smart, mm-hmm. the guy or girl, you know, and you have, like, you know, now it's the same thing applies to the coachable part, I like to look at, like, you know, throw them different things and, you know, see, are they flexible, like, they're intellectually flexible on new things and learning, and, you know, how fast learner they are and how they like to learn new things, etc. So you can make that as part of your you know, interview process, etc. References are important for some roles. References are pretty important, but, you know, it's hard to do references for every role.
Yeah. Second
is, I feel like most of the references are kind of bullshit. You know, it's like people don't say bad things. You know, you have to find the right references. You know, I feel like, you know, many times instead of doing the reference call, you can achieve everything from the reference by just having a list of references. If someone can't give you a good list of references from their prior bosses, etc., that's, like, you know, that's a problem. If they give you a good list of references, you probably don't need to do the call, because you kind of know, like, you know, if these people are willing to be this person's reference, they, you know, that's all good there.
The flip side of hiring, which you've done a lot of, is firing. What have you learned about letting people go that you might want to impart on founders or operators?
Yeah, you know, that's always the hardest thing to learn for any CEO or any leader. But that's probably the single most important decision you have to make most of the times. First of all, like, you know, hiring is not accurate all the time. Like, you know, whatever you do in the hiring process, you know, you're not going to get, like, let's say 8 out of 10 right. So Now you have your 2 out of 10 that are not right. You know, it's, and now how long you stay with them, that's a, that becomes a important question. You know, I like the simple rule of like, you know, if you are, again, going to a framework, but my framework is, if I'm defending someone fourth time, there's a problem. Like when someone comes to me and say, okay, you know, this person is not working out and, you know, we made a mistake. Like, you know, especially if you have a culture which is of openness, transparency, etc., right? Then, you know, and someone comes and like tells you, like, you know, we made a mistake on hiring, like this person is not doing a good job here, whatever it is, right? And I'm defending them, and you know that is fine. But if I'm defending second time, third time, by the time it's fourth time, I know it's a hiring mistake there that I have to defend, whatever that is. And you know, obviously, I'm taking those first three as a feedback, and you know, and as a coaching opportunity for the, you know, for that person, so that they have the opportunity. But if they can't get there, that's a sign that, you know, you have to make a change. But you can figure that out, you know. I think the harder ones are when someone has worked well in the past and you have to remove, you know, them. Those are even harder, because then those require even more thoughtful thinking. Right?
In the early days of AppD, I heard you say you weren't great at fundraising, but now if you look, you've done a fantastic job of fundraising with Traceable and Harness. And what have you learned about the process of fundraising, and maybe even sitting on the venture side of the table sometimes, about selling a compelling vision and getting investors excited about the story?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny, like, you know, at AppDynamics I had to pitch almost like, you know, 30-35 investors, and got a lot of like 30 plus rejections before I got the first term sheet. When I was starting Harness, you know, I had like 30-35 investors pitching me and like, you know, giving me offers, right? So that's, yes, that definitely advantage of the of being a second time founder. So it's not just like, you know, that I've become so much good at fundraising.
Yeah, but you're smarter, you were funnier, all the above.
Yeah,
you know, they're just throwing money at you.
When I was doing those 30-35 rejections at AppD, you know, what I learned was a lot of it comes down to, like, you know, the right story on fundraising. And the right story is storytelling that you have to do as a founder. And the three things about the storytelling that you have to do right. One is the why is this a big opportunity? Because the whole VC model, and, you know, works in big bets, like, you know, and you need the big hits. And so if a company is going to be successful, the chances are pretty low that most companies are going to be successful. But if company is successful, that it's going to be pretty big, that it's going to be, you know, used to be billion was a big deal, and now it's like maybe more than that. But back to a billion now. So let's say, like, you know, would this be $1 billion, you know, company or not? So you have to paint that story well. You know, if you're not painting that bigger story, and, you know, that makes it hard. Second is you have to paint the story of evidence. You know, a lot of it's like, you know, you can paint the story of this is going to be big, but if you know evidence, that's going to be hard to sell. And the evidence comes from, you know, either you have a product in the market already and you're showing traction, you know, or you have, like, you know, you have a lot of customer interviews and you can talk from that, you know, or you have the, you know, you have, like, some cases, like, report and analysts and industry experts, you know, creating that evidence. Most of the times you have some product with some traction is the best evidence, right? And the third is now is about you, right? You have to sell you. Like, why you, right? Because any company you start, you know, you have to compete and you have to make the point, like, you know, why you are the right founder or founders or the team to bet on, why you would be the winners in that particular space. If you get those three, your business does become pretty fundable. So when, you know, when I was getting all these rejections at AppDynamics, right, I was asking people, okay, what's why? I think, why are you rejecting? And, you know, most of the times VCs won't tell you why, you know, but let's say some were good and they will tell you, like, in an honest way, why. And then you start learning from that. You know, some was like, market is not large enough. I will hear that story quite a lot where, like, you know, at this time, this was like, you know, application monitoring. It's application monitoring, that's such a small niche market. Like, this is not like now where you have AppDynamics and New Relic and Dynatrace and Datadog and, like, you know, observability monitoring, like, you know, multiple, you know, companies with like billions and billions of valuation. So market was small wasn't the number one objection I would get. And, you know, at some point I had to start, you know, and I realized that I'm not doing a good job in telling, like, the monitoring does seem like a small niche market, but you have, like, you know, everyone building so much code in the world. And it's so painful to monitor and troubleshoot and fix when the problems happen in the code. And, you know, so to tell the story, you have to tell, like, you know, how many developers are there, you know, and how many, like, you know, application servers or, you know, are being installed and, you know, how much money being spent when something is slows down and why this could be a very large opportunity. But it was not very evident that application monitoring was a large opportunity at that time. You know, so that's something you had to become good at selling. Second was, like, you know, was not evident was the, you know, the evidence around it. Like, you know, how do you prove it, like, that it's going to be a large opportunity? How do you prove a differentiating kind of things? So I ended up then, like, you know, doing a lot of the cold calling kind of the customer conversations to create that, you know, that compelling evidence around it. Because I didn't have a product to show, you know, and I didn't have traction to show. It was like, you know, in those days, it was hard to, you know, build the product without any, especially products like that, without any revenue. The third was I have to sell my story, which was pretty hard for me to sell because I was like a first-time engineer turned founder. I didn't have too much experience, but still had that experience in the domain. I had like a lot of patents in that area, I had to paint the right story, right, craft the right story. Obviously, when you become, like, you know, more successful in one thing, then you maybe have, you can go, you know, easy on the other two areas. Right?
You wrote a blog post in 2017 that we can link in the show notes, but it's about pitching the venture capitalist to work with. And I'm going to read back the points to you, and I would love to get you to elaborate on this framework. So the first one was reach the highest tier of VC firm you can, but don't go overboard comparing firms. Can you talk about what you were thinking in that and in the perspective there?
It's a blog from back in the past before I became a VC, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, so, on how to pick a VC. Me, call me first. And then, yes. Yeah.
The right VC, me, and firm, yes. I would say what I meant was, like, you know, a lot of times people are like, you know, I'm getting, like, founders are figuring out, like, I have offers from three firms and I want to, figure out whom. And many times it's like, you know, this firm is higher in the ranking than this firm, so I need to go there. Like, I try to tell founders, it doesn't really matter. Like, you definitely want to get into the, like, these that you have investors from tier one firms. That's a good validation. That's like, you know, obviously those firms are tier one for a reason. But they're all kind of the same at some level. Like, you know, it's the, and once you are in that tier. And, like, you know, if you look at, like, and people go very overboard on, like, you know, this ranking set, this firm is higher there, and this firm is this, and this is the number one firm, and this number two, and this number three. And so my guidance is, like, you know, look for just that you are in that, you know, you can attract the highest tier possible. And then after that, that becomes a material, like, which firm it is.
And then the second point was, what really matters is the partner.
Yes. That's the second point. Like, what matters is the partner. Because partner is where you will spend so much time. Like, if you're building a company, probably the partner will be deeply involved in a company for 5 years, 10 years, you know, could be longer even these days.
And it's hard to unwind.
It's like, you know, it's pretty much impossible to unwind, right? You know,
divorces happen all the time. Divorces from partners are really hard.
Yes, you know, divorces are much easier compared to divorcing your VC partner in your board. And VC partner in the board, if it's not the right person, then it will create so much friction down the line. And many times people are like, you know, I see founders are like, you know, I'm picking this firm over this firm. But I say, okay, who is the partner that used to be? Like, once it doesn't really matter which firm at some point, the partner will be more important in your journey.
Yeah, look for believers.
That's an important point, you know. You know, the nature of VC business, I think like about probably 80 to 90% investors just invest because of the FOMO. Like, they don't really believe in the opportunity. They're like, you know, all chasing, firm X and partner X is doing a term sheet, so I need to do that. And that's how most of the investing world unfortunately works. I find them like the wrong investors in any company. Like, I look at, like, you know, if you have an option as a founder, look for people who are not investing in your company because other people are investing in your company, which is the majority of them, by the way. You know, that they want to invest in a company because they sincerely believe in your opportunity, irrespective of other investors chasing you, etc. And because the nature of the startup is that things will invariably go bad at some point, or some hard times will happen. And people who are not really believers in you or your company, you know, it will become, you know, much, much harder in hard times because of that. Because they didn't fundamentally believe in it. They just chased you because this was the hot thing. You know, your company was hot, or your category was hot, or your market was hot at that point, but they didn't really fundamentally believe in it. And that's what I look at, like, you know, the one major criteria for most people to follow is, like, find those those investors who sincerely will believe in you, your company, your opportunity, your market, et cetera. Right?
How do you assess that? Is it just in the conversations and getting a feel for how deep of a knowledge base they have in the category or how long they've been thinking about it?
Yeah,
or?
Like how much research they've done in the category, how much knowledge they have, you know, can they tell you about something like, you know, than others? My partner at Unusual Ventures, when we started, John Varionis, I remember like when I was raising capital for AppDynamics, you know, I was talking to a whole bunch of folks and, you know, John came into the meeting with me, you know, and he, before I presented, he knew high level, you know, and he presented to me like, you know, their thesis on that market. You know, a lot of investors I was talking about, like, you know, why monitoring market large enough, et cetera. And he came with a thesis on why monitoring market is large and why the first generation of monitoring kind of companies like Wiley and all are not the right kind of companies for this next world. And, you know, there is a gap here that someone needs to be. And that was a presentation and thing that he had built, not just for me. Actually, he had it built before. He had it, like, built. And I was kind of sold on that. Like, you know, okay, this person already believes in this market and this opportunity and kind of what we're doing. So it becomes easier alignment going forward because he already believes in that. So that's like, you know, that's a good test in many cases. I had another investor, you know, I was talking to who was like much before, and they were like really hard to, like they said, like they will not say no, but they were like just dragging me forever. And, you know, then I had like, you know, two or three term sheets and offers. And the guy was like, oh, you know, now you have once they knew that they have another offer, now suddenly the interest was like so high and they just wanted to, you know, make an offer then. And where they had an opportunity to be the first for a long time, when they didn't, you know. So that to me is like also a sign that you're reading, like, you know, are they really a believer in your opportunity? Or are they only doing it because now others are interested? Like, so if you find people who believe in your opportunity, your company and you, that's the best because it becomes easy.
You said understand what kind of advisor they're going to be. What did you mean by that?
You know, that's the hardest one, you know, and that comes from some, experience over time and the learning set comes with it. What I like to, you know, again, I like to create frameworks that we've talked about. I think of like, you know, when VCs, investors are on your board, right? You know, you want their advice and help and they do want to give advice and help. But I like to call them, they're like two dimensions to it. One is the how qualified they are. And second is how strong their opinions are. You know, and so, you know, like say if you have like highly, highly qualified and you have very strong opinions, still, you know, still great. If you have like, you know, if you're not as qualified and you have very strong opinions, that's really bad situation to be. Because now it's like, you know, the investor has a lot of control in the company normally. You know, they have the, you know, board seats and voting rights and all kind of controls, right? And, you know, now as a founder, you are almost like, you know, someone who is not really that qualified and they hold very strong opinions. You are in a very, you know, strange place with that, right? So I look at like, you know, it's you have the other category where like, you know, someone who is, you know, strong, very qualified, but like still like, you know, softer opinions. They are great as well. You know, those are probably the best ones. And, you know, you have the other category, which is like, you know, you're not very qualified and you have soft opinions. And that's all fine, too, because, you know, you're not at least being disruptive because you can bring other board members and other advisors around you. To me, the worst are the people who are not very qualified and very strong opinions, which is common in the VC world, primarily because, you know, the dynamic of the venture world is like, you know, a few successes and people grow a lot of egos. You know, so the egos get very high. You know, the higher your egos get, your opinions get stronger. And if you're not very qualified and your opinions get stronger, then you become a sort of a bad advisor in the board, right? So that's what I was trying to make the point in that case. Like, you know, if you can figure out, like, you know, what is their advice style? Like, is it like, you know, that this is my point of view and opinion and I'm in the board and, you know, if you have to listen to me as a, and in a very strong opinion, then you better find someone who is like very, very, very qualified for it. You know, otherwise you want people who have like, you know, softer style of giving opinions.
I want to pull out a nuance in there is that qualification as you're defining it doesn't necessarily just mean successes or experience there. That oftentimes you can be fooled by just because they were associated with a successful company early on and they saw that journey doesn't mean that they're qualified to weigh in on the inputs into your company.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. How do you judge someone is qualified to give you an advice or not? And I convert down to a very simple question now. Like, would I have this person in my board if they are not investing? You know, if you have, like, you know, if the answer is yes, like, you know, and this for a variety of reasons, like, you know, this person was maybe a former founder who I respect, or maybe a very seasoned investor that I respect, you know, involved in great companies, or thought leadership in the market that I respect, or, like, you know, or like, you know, that would you take this person as a to be in your board or in some way involved in your company if they were not an investor? If you meet that criteria, then you are in the that bucket. And that's, to me, is very important. Like, you know, if you want to give someone so much control in your company as an investor, and you want to find the people who would be there, or you find people where their style is not, like, you know, dictating their opinions on you, right? So that's important. You know, it's kind of nuanced to it. But when I look at, like, you know, the investor founder conflicts and dramas and all that happen later on, the root of that comes down to this particular area.
Anything you would add to that now besides call you first 6 years after you wrote the post?
You know, it's a good question. Like, after 6 years, I wrote this framework 2017, right? I would say, yes, there is one thing I would add to it, which is the stage appropriateness. And that's very, very important in the when you pick the right investor. Like, what stage your company is, because the help you need in different stages is very different. It's almost like, you know, kind of like a like having a doctor. A doctor for babies is different than a doctor for, you know, when you're a grown up versus when you're, like, you know, if you're trying to get help with cancer. So I do think that stage appropriateness element is important. Like, you know, if you're starting a company, you need help on the very early stages of company building, like going from the $0 to $1 million. You know, and if someone is very, very experienced on the later stages and they're very, very good on the later stages, are they the right investor for you in that stage? Right? So that, you know, that part is important. But otherwise, what happens is, like, you know, you get investors, you know, who are not really the right fit. You know, they would have been great fit for when you were early, or would be great fit when you are late in a few years down the line when you need the help and the advice now. Right? So I think that part is important. And, you know, we talk a lot about that on Unusual Ventures as well, like, which is the you know, when you have to build that kind of mindset, like, you know, where are you focused on? You know, what is the help we can provide at what particular stage, right? So, you know, and founders have to pick that, because that's when they get the most specialized help that they would need.
I want to shift gears a little bit and go to the Apti story, but can you give me the background of you all the way up, not your whole life story, but just leading to the founding of Apti? So you were born in India and then moved over to the States when?
Yeah, I was born in India, did my, you know, went to study computer science in IIT, Indian Institute of Technology, the top engineering schools in India. And I was, like, fascinated by Silicon Valley. I was like, you know, at that time, the Indian startup ecosystem was almost non-existent or very, very, very early.
What year is this?
This was year 2000.
Got it.
So I was, you know, Silicon Valley is the place to come. Let's go here. And I started, you know, where I learned my numbers game kind of thing. Let's apply to a whole bunch of startups and someone will hire me. And I started applying to a lot of startups from India. And I got in Silicon Valley as a startup, because that's what I wanted to work in. And that I wanted to work in a Silicon Valley startup and learn the startup.
Did you have any exposure to it as a kid? Like, how'd you even know? Was it
I had a lot of exposure to, I would call it, like, a mom and pop startup concept. And almost, I grew up in a small town in India, and my dad had a like a business selling, like, you know, ladies bags, you know. He had another business selling irrigation machinery. Like, these are, like, small startups, like, you know, small businesses. Sure. And almost all my family members, like, you know, uncles and, you know, cousins and all, were kind of in these small businesses, because they were not too much other things to do. So there's a lot of, I had a lot of exposure on the small businesses. And when I was a kid, you know, starting when I was, like, maybe 6-7 years old, after school or weekends, you will go to the shop and help your dad. So I kind of learned a lot of the small business thing there. So, you know, it wasn't a startup in the tech startup sense, but they were, like, these small businesses that I was exposed pretty much as a kid. And when I went done engineering, and I almost, like, you know, just, you know, I feel like, you know, that's what I always wanted to do. Like, can I bring the business and the engineering side together? And that's where, like, the tech startups and Silicon Valley and all of that just fascinated me so much. So I was like, let's pack the bags and come here, you know. And I started applying for jobs, and, you know, one of the companies was like, you know, if you can, we can sponsor your visa if you can come here. And I went to my dad and was like, can you find where to pay for my flight? And, you know, you paid for the flight and I got here.
And so that was at the .com, like right in the bubble?
So right before the bubble was bursting. Like, you know, I came here and the bubble was just right about bursting. You know, so that was the, and so that was a pretty hard time. Like, you know, it was almost like, I think it's along those months it was bursting around, you know, almost then. And, you know, and a lot of those startups didn't survive there. But you learn a lot, you know, and like you work in startups and they don't survive and they go through that kind of bubble burst, hard time. You know, it's kind of a lot of learning that happens through that.
And so did you bounce around? How'd you end up at Wiley?
Wiley was at that time my third startup. You know, I worked at two startups before as an engineer. And actually, it was interesting that I was in the startup company called DataSweep, like manufacturing data intelligence kind of thing. Excel was one of the investors. And they were also invested in Wiley at that time. And you know, I was, as an engineer, I was like struggling with like performance troubleshooting for our software. That it was like hard to debug problems and fix things and all. And Wiley was doing their job and I was like, oh, this is a great product, you know. And, you know, this is something this is the area that I, you know, I find interesting. So I, you know, I got it about Wiley. Hmm. And then one of the investors made the connect at that time. And then the Wiley was a great story at that time. It's a great company, you know, we had a lot of good innovative technology. It was acquired by CA, which is Computer Associates for many people who don't know from back in the day. It used to be one of the biggest tech companies at that time in the enterprise software space.
For $450 million or so?
About, yeah, $375
million.
Which used to be a big amount at some point.
That was 2000, what year?
It was 2006. You know, it was pretty clear to me, like, you know, the world is changing. You know, this was when, the AWS just came out. And so it was like everything will move into the cloud at some point. You know, people are building this very distributed software systems. And the products like Wiley and all the previous generation stuff was not really designed for the next generation. Also clear, like, you know, CA compressor is not where any new innovation is going to happen around this. So new starters have to solve this problem in a big way. And that's where I was like, you know, it's kind of, it met my, even though I didn't have a framework like that at that point, it kind of met my three criteria, at least that I was convinced that the market is large. And it turned out to be large. You know, it's like, even if some people didn't believe that time, it was large market. You know, everyone has to monitor and troubleshoot and fix problems in the code. That, you know, that people were struggling with it. I knew it firsthand because I saw the struggle, how people were, the pain was real. You know, it wasn't like a fake pain. Like that was one of the big pain points for almost every software engineer. And then I also, you know, knew that I could build a great, you know, that I was very passionate about it. Like I went from my previous startup to Wiley because I was passionate about that domain. You know, I was working on that for quite some time and I knew that I could spend, you know, time and energy. I knew also I had expertise on it. You know, maybe I didn't have business expertise, but I had a lot of tech expertise on that particular area. And, you know, that I could solve that. So that was kind of my conviction. I still do remember that I was still at Wiley and I was pitching to VCs at that time. And one of the VCs was like, you know, hey, do you really believe in this thing? I said, yeah, I do. You know, so why are you still in your job? And, you know, I don't have an answer. And I slept over it. And next day I quit the job. It's like, yeah, that's a good, like, I do believe in it. So why am I still doing my job? And, you know, because you have to, like, put yourself in that. And I think it's a very valid question at that point. Like, you know, that this founder is asking us to put a lot of money and, you know, they're still, like, you know, not willing to quit the job around this.
How'd you end up a solo founder?
Not by design.
It wasn't intentional.
You know, it just happened, like, you know, I couldn't find the right founder, co-founder fast enough, you know, and things moved. You know, even though, like, you know, I had 35 rejections and all that, but still, like, things moved in the, you know, in a few months. Like, I quit my job. I was already kind of pitching to folks. And, like, you know, after I quit my job, maybe, like, a couple of months, things were moving and like getting offers and term sheets and the company has to get going. I couldn't find, you know, the right co-founder, you know, and there were some attempts where like, you know, almost like the shotgun marriage kind of attempts that were actually the first offer I got from VC was that I had to get a co-founder who was a EIR at the firm, who was a very qualified, you know, very qualified person. But I had to decide to have that person as co-founder, you know, as part of the term sheet in like 2 days. And, you know, I couldn't get comfortable with that. You know, it's like, to get there. And, you know, that person was very qualified, became successful in his own ways, in a very major way. But I just got to a place where I didn't have co-founder. But then the first person I hired was one of the, you know, one of the best engineers I know at Wiley. And, you know, said, okay, come in and, you know, join me here. And over time, he kind of like, you know, even though he wasn't co-founder, but like, you know, he played a lot of the role a co-founder will play, which is like, you know, you're someone you can trust, and you kind of go through the hard times together, kind of, that kind of role. I don't advise, you know, people to go solo if you can find a good co-founder. But at the same time, like, and I won't find co-founder just for the sake of it. Because it's very important. Like, it's as important decision or even as, like, you know, picking the right VC, a VC partner to be on a board is even more important, I would say. So if you know the right person who, like, you know, who you trust, you know, the right person who you respect and admire, you know, that's what you, and you know, like, the role they can bring, right? You know, and you can have your good amount of clarity on it. That's the way to go.
Apti seemed to have a pretty charmed existence from the outside in. I'm sure there was a bunch of chaos in the inside, as there always are in startups. Any particular things that you wish, I mean, we've talked about a bunch of different frameworks and lessons learned along the way and all that stuff, but any particular thing that along the way you wish you knew when you were starting the business?
First of all, charmed existence. that's a pretty fancy word, but you know,
I don't think
anyone has that. Like, there's no startup I can guarantee you has charmed existence. From outside, yes. Inside, no one does. Like, you know, inside is always hard. Like, you know, you always have, like, you know, from outside in the long term, it looks like a big straight line going like that. Like, you know, it's like you have, like, the day-to-day is crazy. But yes, it you know, I think the core of what we had at Right End Up Dynamics was the market was large. And we were the early, kind of early believers that the market was large. Like, you know, that people, it was kind of, we were in the earlier stages of that application observability kind of space. Second was our product was very, very, very strong. Like, we always were the best product in the market. It was hard for people to catch up on the product innovation that we were doing. And then we started building the very strong sales, execution tied to it. So, and, you know, and then I always had the fundamental belief on customer success, you know, which many people find very odd that how much I talk about customer success, but that's something I was always obsessed with, that the every customer has to be value, get value and be successful. And so those are the things that made it kind of easy in some ways. Like, if you get those, the flywheel works with that, right? You know, that your market is large, so that's kind of a, you know, tailwind to begin with. You know, now you have the, you know, your product is strong and your sales are executing well and you have the, your customers are happy, the flywheel starts moving, right? You know, and then you can keep growing from there.
Your major competitor ended up being your old boss from Wiley. Any funny stories about that? Like, because for people that don't know, Lucerne started New Relic, and New Relic was kind of the mid-market version, and Apti was the enterprise version. Any funny stories?
It was a strong, healthy competition. Like, you know, so Lou, I have a lot of respect for him. He was the founder at Wiley, and he was my boss at Wiley. And he, you know, so after, you know, a lot of people at Wiley had the same realization that this market is just starting. You know, there's a lot of people building these modern distributed apps and things moving in the cloud and, you know, next generation solutions to it. And so Lou started New Relic about a year before I started AppDynamics. And he had a different thesis on a few things, you know. First of all, the programming languages. You know, his thesis was the modern programming languages like Ruby, etc. will become more dominant. And they were growing very fast and they became pretty, pretty, pretty popular there. That you could, you know, you don't need salespeople. He had a strong thesis on that as well early on. And, you know, he was a great mentor and advisor to me as well. So when I started AppDynamics, actually, we didn't think it would be competitive because I had a very different, thesis on, like, you know, that the new languages like Ruby, etc. are getting in popularity, but a lot of large enterprises still code in Java. And there's a lot of pain points in Java, so I wanted to focus on Java. So we actually had initially, you know, he was, you know, it's kind of most, a lot of people don't know, he was, for the very, you know, for the first, when I just quitting my job and starting, he was advisor to AppDynamics. You know, because we didn't think it was, you know, that will compete. People will be like, you know, okay, he was building for Ruby, you know, and I was building for Java. And, you know, I knew that Java was more large enterprise, so I need to build more to sell into enterprise and figure that out. And he knew, like, Ruby was more this kind of younger tech company, so he wanted to build a go-to-market model around that as well, which actually didn't really need salespeople. So we actually started like that. But, you know, a few years down the line, you know, if you're good companies, you figure out where the opportunities are, and they start to converge, right? The markets start to converge invariably. So it did start to converge, and we had a very strong, healthy competition for a long time. You know, and we became very good at what our strength was, which is, like, you know, selling for very complex, you know, applications in larger companies, larger environments, you know, Java, .NET, those kind of programming languages. New Relic became very good at, like, you know, selling into SMB, high velocity languages like, you know, Ruby and PHP, etc. So, you know, and both became successful in a major way.
There's this now legendary story about selling the business to Cisco while employees were already in New York for the IPO stock listing. So can you tell that story? But then also, how do you come to the decision to sell? I'm sure it's a emotional and financial decision. So what were the inputs into that?
Yeah, I'll start with the story. I think many people might have heard that before. It's you know, we were about to go public. A lot of people ask me, "What are you doing a dual track for your IPO versus acquisition?" And I tell them, "There's no dual track. We were just doing IPO." And we had IPO planned for, you know, this was February of 2017, and Thursday of that week of one of the weeks there, and Cisco came in a few days before, and, you know, they made an offer, and I'll go back to the decision process. They made the first offer, you know, we said no to, and then they made the second offer, we said no to, and then they made a third offer, and we said, you know, yep, so, like, we should have to do it. But we had, like, you know, for IPO, we planned on that we'll take our, like, you know, mostly our first 20-30 employees and some of the people who played a big role in the over the time as well. So, like, in about 40 employees or so, we'll go to NASDAQ and we'll ring the bell and do an IPO. And most of these people, you know, they're very, obviously very, it's a very proud moment, exciting moment. And, you know, most of them are engineers, you know, and most engineers don't have a suit, you know, as you know. And they're like, you know, people were, they got a suit made for the IPO and everything was planned there. And they were in Wall Street, in New York for that. And we announced that we are getting acquired like less than 24 hours before that IPO moment. And all these people were like in New York for the IPO, and again, we are selling the company for like pretty good amount, $3.7 billion. And everyone was sad that, you know, what about my suit? Like, you know, yeah. I just got it for the IPO. And
I think NASDAQ had like cupcakes and stuff with their logos all that. Yeah.
You know, so actually the good thing was we were able to make a deal with Cisco. So Cisco has a big clout on NASDAQ. So we made a deal with them on, like, you know, hey, can you, if we close the deal with you, can you still go and ring the bell on NASDAQ? And, you know, they did their work, and, like, you know, once the deal was closed, like 2-3 months later, we actually did go back and did ring the bell and did the same kind of thing. But so it was, you know, which was a good moment.
And so the decision, the inputs into the decision. I mean, obviously you said no twice, yeah. And
I think if you think about, like, you know, who are the stakeholders in deciding if to sell the company or not? You obviously have the founders. You know, in AppDynamics case, I was the only founder. You know, you have the board and mostly investors, let's say, like, you know, your majority who own majority of the company, and then you have employees who have, like, you know, put in all the hard work in building the company, and they all shareholders and they all have a lot of input. So at certain price, you know, it makes sense for all stakeholders. At certain price, it doesn't, right? You know, for some stakeholders. So as you know, when I looked at it as founder, for me, it didn't, you know, so. If we went IPO, we would have gone IPO around. Our initial pricing was like $1.4 billion, and we would have gone through, like, you know, kind of the normal, that, you know, the interest was very high, so, you know, repriced it higher to go, you know, around 1.6 or so. And, you know, the Cisco offer initially was kind of like, you know, not too far off from there, and it makes sense, like, you know, why won't we go public and you know, if we go public at 1.6 billion, you know, it's we'll take that chance. And, you know, the final offer was $3.7 billion, right? So which was more than which is about 2.5x of what we would have gone IPO with, and would have taken us, you know, a couple of years, you know, at least to build towards that, like, you know, all the market valuations change and all, but let's assuming the multiples and all stayed the same. So you start looking at like what's the risk, you know, in going forward from here, like, you know, 3 years from now, you know, do you take that or not? What is the right thing for the stakeholders involved? You know, personally for me as a founder, at some point it doesn't make really a difference from the from a financial perspective. Like it's still, you know, both outcomes are financially
only great. So many beach houses you can have,
yeah,
right?
Kind of, yes. So it doesn't
seems
really...
like you're still working anyway, which yeah.
Yes, because beach houses can get boring after some time. Yes. Right? So if you're too much on the, in there. But then, you know, you have the investors, you know, and investors have different opinions on that. And then you have the, you know, the employees. And, you know, we it was pretty hard. The it was like a 3 days of process, like, you know, back and forth, decision making. We were all holed up, like, you know, 3 days. People probably had like 2 hours of sleep in 3 days, you know, in getting all this done. And it's a hard decision. It's a very bittersweet decision also. Like, you know, it's like, do you end the journey? Do you continue? Do you sell the company or not? You know, no one is, at the same time, it is like very... Like, it's a great outcome financially for everyone. You know, we had 400-plus employees who made more than $1 million. You know, so it's a financially very life-changing outcome for a lot of people. People made, like, you know, tens of millions of dollars as well. But it's there's no easy answer to it. Like, you know, I was really, really sad when it closed. Like, I can tell you that. You know, we had a big celebration party, and you come home from the celebration party, and you're kind of depressed, you know, because it's, like, kind of the end of a... You know, end of the journey in some in many ways. No easy way to do it, but I would say, like, you know, you have to look at like what's the risk profile, what happens for the next few years. Also, like, how do you know your business well? You know where the gaps and challenges were. We had some gaps and challenges that you know that we knew, you know, that would have made it harder. But at the same time, in hindsight, the market actually exploded after that. Yeah. You know, and business, you know, Cisco did a good job with the acquisition for the first few years. And you know, after that, it becomes like, you know, becomes a bit different. We would have been valued much more actually over time. Yeah. So like it's now, if you look back, like, you know, 5-6 years later, was it the right thing to do or not? But I do think at that time it was the right thing for all shareholders.
Was there a specific conversation you had along the way, or like an input? You referenced the 400 plus people making $1 million that really swayed you, or was it just...
I think that was the biggest point for me. Like, you know, it's like I have 400 employees who can make $1 million plus here. You know, we're getting a value that's like, you know, it will take 3 to 4 years to grow into that valuation. And... So, you know, do we take a chance with, like, you know, all this financial impact that all the employees are going to get now or not, right? And, like, yes, we could have gone public and, you know, and taken that chance in the public market for the next 3-4 years. And that was really, to me, the biggest factor on deciding that.
I want to get your quick takes on the current state of the markets and where we are today. So you're operating two companies, as we referenced, Traceable and Harness. You've had to raise a bunch of money throughout the cycles for both. What's your perspective on the current state of the technology market, the venture landscape, all that stuff?
You know, I have a point of view which is a little bit different than many people. I feel it's a great opportunity and actually a pretty good thing, the current state of the markets. You know, we all got, in the tech world, we all got, let's say, a bit too sloppy because there was so much money easily available. The valuations were too high, money was so cheap, interest rate was low, you know, all of that stuff. And companies were not really executing well. And I will start with, like, even my own companies, like, you know, AppDynamics, as I mentioned, like, you know, was kind of gone through that fire test in the 2008 recession. You know, I started AppDynamics in March of 2008, and we raised our round, et cetera, at that time, like, you know, about $5 million. In September 2008, the big crisis happened, and, you know, it was like almost like 2009 and 10 were like just really, really bad for any kind of fundraising. So it was really clear, like, at that time, like, you know, we need to, like, operate in a very, very strong discipline, you know, focus on the core areas, you know, focus on, like, you know, that your product has to be very strong so you can reduce the cost of sales. You know, you have to, you know, don't do things that, like, you know, don't matter, you know, do things that, you know, create good amount of efficiency. And that became the core foundation of how AppDynamics was built. But the money was so easy and cheap in, like, the, you know, in the for many years after that, like, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years before this correction, that it creates the company's culture in not the best way. And including, I've seen that even in my own companies as well, like, you know, you just don't have any pressure to operate in the most optimal, efficient way. So I think this is a great opportunity that this is happening and this correction is happening. And, you know, it's so strange, like, you know, you can pretty much operate the same, deliver the same outcome with significant lower cost and, you know, much highly efficient kind of model if you pay attention to it. And the money was so cheap, no one was paying attention to it, you know, so which is kind of unhealthy to me, like, you know, as a company. Like, most companies are not doing any profits and cash flows, and, you know, even as a public company, you'll be like 5 years, 7 years, you're not cash flow positive. And so it's a great opportunity in that sense. Mm. Obviously, there's a lot of bad outcomes that come with it. Like, there's a lot of pressure with the, in the, you know, with the, to the employees, you know, layoffs and job cuts, and, you know, the startups not being able to raise capital, you know, all of that, those things are there. I really think those are also not necessarily bad. Like, we need to get to a right balance, because we got into, as an industry, we got into a too craziness there. You know, in a lot of startups that were getting funded and getting started and going probably didn't need it to be. So we have a more, kind of the more, let's say, the real capitalism of tech, VC, Silicon Valley kind of model, that how it's all started. Like, you know, you fight and compete, and the good ideas and the good execution and the good companies, you know, make it into it, and they generate a lot of profits and value and all that. And we were starting to kind of dilute down on that too much. So I personally feel like, you know, it's a good thing in the long term. Short term, we go through obviously a lot of pain.
You have a .AI on one of your companies, Traceable.ai, and then Harness, I think, is leveraging artificial intelligence as well. What do you think about that market and that opportunity?
You know, AI is massive. No, you can't deny it in any ways. You know, one thing I like to, you know, so at Harness, we launched a lot of generative AI capabilities for you know, software development lifecycle. You know, how do you do deployments and testing and everything? And people will say, oh, now you're on the AI bandwagon as well. I said, okay, you should look at when we launched Harness in the market, you know, 5 years ago. 5 years ago, when we launched in the market, we were the first one to bring AI into DevOps at that time. You know, it's like the, you know, I was, you know, like there was an article about in TechCrunch about us generating, launching our AI now. So, okay, look at the article 5 years ago in TechCrunch when we launched the company. It was also all about AI. So we have been doing AI from 5 years ago, not just now. And same with Traceable. Like, you know, Traceable is out there for, like, you know, 3 years. It has AI in its name and its fundamental technology from then. I'm a strong believer in AI. I do think it's really the next frontier of you know, how you, of kind of a technology that can apply to almost any discipline. So any discipline, whether it's like, you know, developer tools or cybersecurity or marketing tools or sales management, customer support management, I do think, you know, AI has a strong potential there to make that whatever the workflow is, you know, anywhere from 2x to 5x better, you know, maybe even more, you know. So everyone has to leverage that. You know, I'm not a huge believer in, like, you know, generic AI, at least for the startup, but I feel like, you know, AI for a purpose. Whatever the workflow you want to, the problem you want to solve, that's massive, and every company should do it.
One of the things that I think you'll agree with is, given especially that you're working still, despite not needing to after the success of AppDynamics, is not living your life or not spending your time to then go live your life and working towards some end and not enjoying the journey along the way. How has that impacted you? How do you sort of think about following your passions or your work on a day-to-day basis, and advice for anyone that's kind of thinking through their career?
It's always a very interesting question on why you do what you do, right? So after AppDynamics was sold, and, you know, I didn't have to stay there at Cisco at all, because I was the day-to-day responsibilities were already handed off. The first instinct was that I can retire now, that I don't need to do anything. I should just retire. And I did retire.
So, you were how old at the time?
I was early 30s.
Yeah.
I retire as in, like, you know, let's do things that, you know, actually I was putting things on hold when I was doing AppDynamics. Right. So I had, like, you know, a big bucket list of things that I need to go safari in Africa, and I need to hike in the Himalayas and Bhutan, and I need to hike Machu Picchu, and I want to, you know, see the fjords in Norway. And I had a whole list. And it's okay, let's just do it. And like 6 months, the whole list was done. You know, but it was great 6 months. You know, 6 months of my bucket list was done at that time. And I was like, okay, what next? Like, am I really going to be like this? And this is what really put away. And I realized that I enjoyed the AppDynamics journey. it wasn't a means to an end to just do the that what I'm doing. Like, I actually really enjoyed that. That's what I want to do. Like, that's what I like the you know, kind of the tension of operating, you know, competing in the market and building good products. And it's like, it's that's what I enjoy. And that's when I started looking at, like, you know, I need to not think about, like, you know, what's that this is an outcome to something, but I need to do it because this is what I enjoy. But I like to build frameworks, right? So obviously, I have to have a framework for something like this. So I put a very simple, okay, let me list down, like, you know, let's say, you know, 10, 15 years from now, what would I look back? What would I look at, like, you know, I did all the things I wanted to do, right? You know, and, you know, the obviously, I want, because one thing I decided that I cannot do, that let's do things, and once you achieve those things, then you do something else. Let's try to do a balance of everything, like, so which includes, like, you know, fun, family, you know, friends, you know, your intellectual challenge of work, you know, what you like to do, you know, anything that you want to do, like, you know, can I get a healthy balance of doing it? And that's what I look at. People say you're running three things and, you know, or two companies full time and, you know, venture capital and everything. How do you balance anything, your time for everything? I said I do, actually, because that's how I like to manage it. And because I if I'm committing to this for the long term, this is what I would like to do. And I might be doing this job that I do for, who knows, like, my whole life. I can't put things on hold on other parts of the life, right? You know, a few things you can, like, you know, actually I put a list and I said, okay, there may be one or two things I can put on hold, but not nothing else. Like, you know, I was very interested in philanthropy, but, you know, I decided that for me to really go deep into it, I need to put on hold that one, like, you know, that I will deal with 10 years later. But everything else I was able to balance. But I do think that's very important at some point. Like, you have to do what you know, to be, nothing wrong with, like, you know, working for the end. Like, you know, let's say you have a passion that doesn't produce too much money. And so you want to work in a job that will produce money. So you have to do a passion. That's also fine. But if you can find something where, like, you know, what you're passionate about and what you enjoy can give you the lifestyle and the you know, things that you need, that's, you know, then it's great. And if you have already the lifestyle and the money and all that you need, then it's great also, because you can continue to do what you're passionate about. So for me, the driver on always is being good at what you do. I like the, you know, that kind of, just that mindset of, like, you know, if I want to be an entrepreneur in this space, I want to be very good at my craft. That's my craft. Like, that's, you know, okay, like, you know, if I want to be investor fully, I want to be good at that craft. Like, whatever the craft is, you want to be good at your craft. And kind of the view, to be good at that craft, you have to enjoy it. You know, there's no way, like, you know, if you want to be a really good pianist, you have to enjoy playing piano. If you are doing it just to an end, means to an end, you're not going to be, never be. You know, if you want to be great at, you know, playing basketball, you have to enjoy playing basketball. You can't just be doing it for that it's a, it means to some kind of end, right? So I feel happy, I feel fortunate that I found that this is what I like. You know, sometimes there are times when I feel I made a mistake, you know, that's crazy and do I really enjoy it, you know? But, you know, those are bad days, as you know, in the world of startups and things, you know, impossible to not have bad days. But in general, I think, like, you know, it's good to find something you enjoy.
Well, Jyoti, thank you for doing this. This was great. Amazing frameworks and inspirational to see you execute on this job that you're done being an outside observer on the App Dynamics path, and then now Harness and Traceable and Unusual. So thank you for doing this.
Yeah, great to be here and catching up also.